You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
I kind of feel like when you get out of your own way, that's where the magic is. And it's that way with everything. It's not just music. I feel like, you know, athletes, everything. Once you are able to stay present and kind of whatever that thing is, I can't articulate it, but it is amazing how the universe will kind of inform you. And I've heard songwriters talk about this before, where they're just trying to tap into the song and it's all there. It's just a matter of tapping to it and grabbing it. And there are times where you really just don't feel like it's weird. As a songwriter, you almost feel like, well, it's all there. The universe, it's there in the universe. You know, I'm just channeling something, and some people are like, oh, that's BS, you know, whatever. But that's super, you know, mystic and or whatever you want to, however you want to describe that philosophy. But there have been moments where songs come about and you're like, I don't know how that happened. It really felt like the universe dropped it in my lap.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 2020. We're not going to get redundant on you now. I'm just going to do my normal intro, and then you can move on to the featured presentation. My name is Benny Goodman, and I'm here with my cohorts, my compatriots, Corey Pesa and Siobhan Cronin.
What's going on?
Hey, Ben.
And this week we have one of the greatest. We had the GOAT, Nuno Bettencourt, on last week for guitar. And I would say that if there was any contention as far as who could be the GOAT in the rock realm of vocalism, if that's a thing.
It is now.
This guy, Miles Kennedy, is certainly on that list as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Incredible guy. So without further ado, check it out, part one with Miles
thanks
Kennedy.
To our British ambassador, Steve Wood, for getting him on the show. Thank you, Steve. Like, he's in those credits for a reason. Subscribe. Thanks, Steve.
Hello and welcome to another episode of 2020. We are super pumped today to welcome our guest, Mr. Miles Kennedy of Alter Bridge. He has a solo record out, Ides of March. He also plays with a little guy named Slash. You know, you might have heard of him. Thank you for joining us, Miles.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you were connected via our British ambassador on the show, Steve Wood, who's a dear friend of ours, has been on the show before, and it's really a pleasure to have you here. We've been talking about you. We talked to your bandmate, Mark Tremonti, so we have so many questions for you. It's really an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, I'm thrilled to be here, so thanks for bringing me into the fold here. This will be fun.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that wonderful mic you're talking into right now. It sounds crisp.
Sounds so good.
It's red. It's red, so it doesn't even have to be good. I already want to buy it just because it's red.
There you go. The Miles Kennedy signature microphone. Shameless, totally shameless plug. But yeah, I'm pretty happy with how it sounds. I'm glad it's coming across well.
Well, we're audio nerds.
And we're also very shameless, so feel free to delve into as much as you'd like.
You obviously you wear in ears all the time, and you have to have a very specific microphone. Apparently you have your own. What are the qualifications for Miles Kennedy to have his own microphone? Why? What's better about it? Educate this guitarist.
You know, it's got a flex capacitor built right in. So
88 miles an hour, bro. I can't run that fast on stage.
So this is a true story. I didn't realize this, but I used to always joke about flex capacitors forever. You know, anything technically, I would be, oh, it's a flex capacitor from Back to the Future. Well, I could be wrong here, but I was with he'll remain nameless for now, but he's a well-known producer, and he actually told me, he said, you do realize that there is a flex capacitor in like old analog tape machines. I did, and I was like, really?
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know, but yeah. So as far as the mic goes, I used a very tried and true kind of industry standard mic for probably the first like three decades of, you know, just doing this, you know. It's, I guess, not to age myself, but I've been doing it for a long time, and I would not veer away from this specific microphone. It was engineers would always be like, oh, try this mic or try this mic, and because, you know, engineers want to hear certain things. And I was like, yeah, but I'm so used to this industry standard. And then someone put this mic in front of me. I was on tour with Alter Bridge a few years ago. And I was like, okay, we'll try it during soundcheck, right? And within, by the time we got to the first chorus, I was just like, I don't know what's going on here. But first of all, it's like there's, we always have a problem with cymbals bleeding into these mics, like more than the vocals,
you know? Sure.
Depending on where I'm standing on stage. So these mics do a pretty good job of rejecting that. And it's just a very pleasing microphone as far as what I need to hear, you know, all the frequencies are there. And I love it.
It sounds amazing. I mean, you're definitely the best sounding guest. I mean, even of all three of us, it sounds phenomenal.
That says a lot about our show. So it's funny that a lot of people, like guitarists and drummers and a lot of musicians have to really be selective about their gear. You don't think about vocalists being that picky. Usually, I mean, especially at the level that I play at, you show up to the club and you get a dented 58 covered in beer and spit, and you're just like, all right, cool, it works, we're functioning, right?
The dented 58 with, and then you look, it's funny because you look at the top part. I'm sorry, it's
windscreen.
The windscreen, jeez, Miles. And there's always like food particles, and it's just disgusting. Disgusting.
Sorry, Ben.
No, that's, I was gonna say, I thought it was my density for Miles to come on our show.
Density.
It was a giant
that
black Back to the Future thing.
That was very good.
The second show in a row you've been able to use that reference.
It was Chuck Berry good. Because there's it's funny you say this because this is a giant Back to the Future joke. I just posted a picture of me with Chuck Berry because I met him one time, and the guy I had take the picture was Leonard Cohen. And I was so stupid, I asked this guy, Leonard Cohen, to fucking take the picture of me and Chuck Berry, which is just all kinds of weird, because I'm in a room with Leonard Cohen and Chuck Berry, and I give this old man a fucking phone. I'm like, can you point this at me and the father of rock and roll? And you are hugely influenced by Jeff Buckley, which at the time I didn't know, that guy with the fucking fedora wrote Hallelujah.
Exactly.
What's up with that?
You did. It sounds like have you heard the story? Wolfgang Van Halen posted a picture of a guy who asked Eddie Van Halen to take a picture of him and Wolfie.
Yes. It's like the third level of Inception.
It's a wacky world.
Oh, my God.
Adorable.
Gosh. Yep. Well, coming back to you, Miles, you know, I'm sort of the introspective one of the group here, and I always love to ask our guests a little bit about who they are as people, where they came from, how they were drawn to music. You know, obviously, we all three know about you, have listened to your music. I've listened to lots of podcasts that you're in, so I feel like I know you a little already. Can you talk to some of the people that may not know you so well about a little bit about your upbringing, you know, how you got drawn to music? Obviously, you started playing guitar at a certain point, discovered being a vocalist. You have a really interesting story.
Yeah. Well, I was initially drawn to, my first musical memory was being, it was when I lived in Boston. I lived just outside of Boston as a child. And I was watching Sesame Street, and they had a special guest that day, and it was Stevie Wonder. And I remember just thinking, whoa, what is this? This is the greatest thing I was 4 years old. And interestingly enough, it's one of like the earliest memories I have as a child was that moment. So that was a really important moment that helped kind of send me on my way. And I know my father, when he was alive, he listened, music was always playing in the house. He was really into Scott Joplin and all sorts of crazy stuff. And so I think it was kind of laid out for me, you know, in that sense. But then fast forward a few years later, and I was just a young teenager trying to figure out what his identity was going to be and where he was going to, you know, what he was going to do with his spare time. And I was playing football or something with my little brother in the backyard, and all of a sudden Eruption came on. You know, Eddie Van Halen, it came on the radio, and leading into Girl, You Really Got Me. And that was another one of those moments where it just, every time stopped, you know, everything, I just stopped what I was doing, and it was just completely mesmerized. And then about 2 hours later, Whole Lot of Love came on. So that kind of set it up. That was like the whole thing. And then it was like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to play music somehow. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to be like a musician. I just wanted to play. I wanted to know what was happening. I wanted to try and understand how to achieve some of that awesome stuff that I was hearing. And it was great because it kept me out of trouble, and it gave me a real purpose from an early age, you know, and so I wasn't bouncing around getting into trouble. I had other friends who were, you know, doing stuff the kids do, and I was locked away in my room trying to figure out how to play Eruption.
That's amazing. And from what I've listened, you had an interesting family life. I heard that you lost your father at a very young age, and you know, I actually lost my dad when I was quite young too. And I'm wondering if music, if that kind of influenced you a little bit as you were getting into your own and playing, if that's something that you really turned to in music to sort of cope with that. I don't know if you can talk about that at all.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it still is, to be perfectly honest with you. It's kind of the saving grace. I mean, I don't know what I'd do without it. I don't know how people function without some sort of outlet, some sort of creative outlet, whatever it is that kind of gets them, whatever gets you through the night, as the song lyric went. And, I think that having the opportunity to learn an instrument and instruments and try to figure out how to utilize that to express what was going on here was really, really helpful. And yeah, there was a lot of loss, a lot of, as you know, you lose a parent at a young age and you're trying to figure all that stuff out. So it was good to have that outlet, the musical outlet, to kind of sort through that.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you, when you gravitated to music, did you get lessons, or, you know, how did you learn all these songs and the things that you wanted to grab onto? Where did you get the training? Were you self-taught? What was that like?
So I tried seeing a traditional guitar instructor, and he was great. But we went right to the Mel Bay book, and I already could read music because I played trumpet. My mom kind of nudged me in that direction when I was about 10, which was good. So that helped. But I had no desire to play Mary Had a Little Lamb. I wanted to play rock songs. And I had a friend who lived down the street who already knew a few songs. So I'd go to his house, and he'd write in tablature. Like, I think I have some of the early ones. One that was really, I remembered that I loved was Diary of a Madman, trying to figure that out. I thought that Randy Rhoads guitar part was amazing. When it came time to like try to understand scales and all that, I ordered, do you remember Circus Magazine? This was way back in, back in the day. And there was always this ad with this really cool looking picture that someone had drawn of this dude like holding the guitar, and it was called the Metal Method, Doug Mark's Metal Method. And it was amazing. You remember?
I remember. Oh yeah.
Right? It's sweet. And that's what I did. I ordered the Doug Mark's Metal Method, and I basically lived in my bedroom with those audio cassettes and those little books, and that's kind of what got me off to the it started, and then I got an
You know, like, well, then, and then you had to do the double neck. Like, oh, I don't know why that's coming.
Michelangelo Badio.
It's Badio, because he says, Michelangelo Badio, I'm going to give you the keys to the Lamborghini. And then he's got the two guitars. He's like, this is how you do it.
It's amazing.
And you're... And then of course you have to have the Paul Gilbert, the purple guitar with the crazy hair, like, just watch me. And then like every guitar player, and now there's YouTube. So I actually have a very important question, because I saw you first off with Rick Beato, who I just learned about. This guy's like, I feel like he's like the Anthony Bourdain of music.
Like that's like great, this guy, analogy.
Like, he kind of looks like him, and he's super cool. And then you hear him play, and you're like, holy shit, this guy's
guitar player.
He has every reason to be talking to Brian May. Like, I want to hate him, but then secretly I'm like, now I just want to be that guy.
Yeah,
but you talked about your guitar playing, and we know a lot. Everyone's heard the story about how, you know, Mark Tremonti, one of the greatest guitar players on the planet, heard you play. From the other room, was like, why is this guy not playing? But you've kind of downplayed your guitar playing, like you say you see these guys on YouTube and all that, but I call those guys 45 second warriors, because for me, what's important is the songwriting and the composition and the reason for that solo, because there's the Rusty Cooleys and the Michelangelo Badios and all of that, but did they write 1,000 words? And for me, you know, having been in the band Lost Symphony, which is what we're in, which is like, I guess, almost like the Olympics of guitar playing, I find the most refreshing thing something I can hum. You know what I mean? And I think that with this new album, The Ides of March, like, dude, I could not believe how good the guitar solos are.
Wow.
Like, you're not pretending that, like, you're not good anymore, are you? Like, you're not being humble about this, because it's like, sounds like Greg Howe and Eric Johnson made a baby, then played better.
Oh, geez. Now, that's too kind.
And you did the greatest thing ever. I'm gonna, one last thing. If people doubt you on guitar, you just pull out a slide, and then everyone's like, holy shit, he can play slide.
Well, I do like, I try, you know, look, I that's, wow, that's really nice. I'm a fan of guitar. I like guitar, and I really, really enjoy it. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just, I guess the way I look at it is like the moments when you're not, because I guess I'm like, songwriting is so important to me, but then those moments where you have the opportunity to play a solo, I always hope that it's like somewhat melodic, there's a melodic element to it. And then there are just a few, you punctuate it with a few little runs here and there to kind of like, you know, it says something. That's what I love when I listen to certain guitar players when they execute a certain passage, you know, a technical passage. If it's, it can be emotion, just as emotional as a wonderful bend with vibrato. And so it's really just trying to balance all that. And ultimately, like we talked about earlier, it's that trying to express something. You're trying to just kind of purge, have this emotion. And sometimes solos help you do that. But I honestly don't consider myself in the realm of even the guys who just, you know, those guys are like A-list players. I'm a singer who loves to play guitar and whatnot, but I appreciate the kind words. Thank you.
So at what point did you discover yourself as a singer, or more so even a songwriter? Because, you know, for example, me, right, I'm an instrumentalist, I play violin, and I have the worst, hardest time trying to write even a melody, you know, because it's just, I have the opposite brain. So at what point did you discover your ability to do that and like kind of indulge in it?
It was kind of early. So I was in a band when I was about 16 or so. I'd only been playing guitar for about a year or two at that point. And so we started playing covers like we all do. And then we were like, well, let's do some originals. So started writing riffs and whatnot and bringing them to the band, and didn't really think much of it. I thought everybody could just write. And in fact, I was more... because I knew guys who could play like Yngwie solos, like, wow, now that's what I wanted to do. Like, how do they do that? This is just writing my own song. I guess I took it for granted initially. So it was pretty early out of the gate that I started to develop that, not understanding how important it would be later on in life. So I'm kind of grateful.
Yeah. And what about singing? So you were writing songs as a guitar player primarily first, right? So at what point did you start singing?
Well, I mean, the first gig I ever sang at was in 1986 at the what's called the Drug Free Rock Off here in Spokane, where I live now. And
was McGruff the Crime Dog there? Remember that? If it was that time period, McGruff the Crime Dog should have been there.
Probably was. He probably probably jammed.
Dare.
we played this battle of the bands, and everybody took turns singing. We had five songs, and one guy did a Hendrix song, another guy did a Rush song, another guy sang a Rush song, and I got elected to do Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin because I don't know for whatever reason. So that was the moment where that was like my coming out as a singer. And interestingly enough, then I didn't do it for another, I don't know, it was probably 4 or 5 years. I just wasn't hardwired for it out of the gate. I just wanted to play guitar, do a solo, go back and hang out with the drummer. I didn't want to be the center of attention. And it seemed like a lot of work. And there was a guy I was playing in bands with through high school, and he was great at it. He was his name is Jason Stewart. He was a total star. The guy was amazing. Like, so I was like, I can't do that. but it became necessary when I was, really writing songs, like doing the vocals and the lyrics and all that. Then it was like, okay, you got to do this, accept it and go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I read that you actually went to college for music, correct? And you studied, was it music theory or something kind of technical within music?
I studied a whole bunch of technical geeky stuff. I studied music theory for a couple years. And so I was a commercial music jazz studies. That was my major. So I could do everything.
Did you have any friends at all?
We were all kind of a tight-knit group of just complete nerds that would hang out all the time, who just, you know, obsessed about music. But outside of that, no. I've never been cool. I've never had a ton of friends just because I'm a music nerd. And in fact, I was in high school, I was in the marching band as well. And we used to get a lot. I mean, they call us band geeks, and they would,
sure,
the jocks would make fun of us. And, you know, it's just, that's the thing. But
so that was back in the trumpet days, correct?
Trumpet days, yeah. Trumpet days. And Yeah, so I was always a music nerd, and it was great because it was like finding my tribe. It was like, you know, you find like-minded individuals, and this is kind of what we were talking about earlier. When you discover something you're really passionate about, and you gravitate towards people, it's like a magnet. You come together, and you have a common purpose.
And I feel like that used to be true because like you could walk down the street and see someone wearing an Iron Maiden shirt, and you're like, Maiden. You just look at it. Now it's like Kendall Jenner is wearing the Maiden shirt, and now we don't know if the girls really are like wearing the Slayer Hell Awaits and they've actually listened to it, or they're like, what are you talking? It's on your shirt. It's on. But back in the day, I felt like as a metalhead, you're right, you could walk around like, okay, he's wearing a Queen shirt, he's cool, he's wearing a Megadeth shirt, like he's one of the metal dudes, but he's again cool, like Marty era, that's awesome, right. But like now it's confusing. Like, do you feel like music, as far as like what you grew up listening to, like who inspired you like to be the guitar player that you are? Because when I listen to this record, like, you know, it's so, there's like fusion and jazz and all this funky stuff, and like, and I went and like looked up your influences, and it's all over like the board, like a guy like Frank Gambale. Like, tell me about that, because I love Gambale and yeah. I hear it now.
Gambale, have you seen? There's a really great interview that Rick Beato does with him. It's you got to check it out.
Of course he does. No.
Yeah,
of course he does.
It's amazing. Yeah. Frank Gambale. So I saw Frank Gambale perform in the late. It was the late 80s. He was with Chick Corea's Electric Band. And it was just completely mind-blowing. And I went through a period where I was trying to emulate his sound. I found a Macy Boogie amp that was similar to what he used. And I had the Ibanez Saber. And I was, but there's no way I was going to do the sweeps the way he did. So I just finally kind of threw in the towel. But
how about the Gambale tuning? Have you tried the Gambale tuning?
Oh, what's the good Gambale tuning?
Oh, this is going to blow your mind, dude. So listen to this. Hold on. Sit down. This is amazing. So I saw Frank Gambale do this, and I'm not that smart, so I can't handle the strange tunings. But this tuning, first off, it plays like a normal open tuning, but listen to this. The bottom string is tuned to A, and then it's all tuned in standard, yeah. But the top two are down an octave, so it's opposite,
like the opposite
of
Nashville tuning, but in A instead of standard.
Oh, that's, and when you play it, all the notes are very close, like a piano phrasing. So, right. You know, there's a lot of overlapping notes. And so if you play just a normal bar chord, it's like a very cool Van Halen style inversion just right. By playing it. So if you want to blow your mind, check out Gambale tuning. I feel like you should learn how to, you'll immediately write 10 songs.
If you sit down with that, you'll write a song in like 10 minutes. It's
right away.
It's a very interesting way to play chords.
But you also, it's interesting because I'm writing, I've been chipping away at the next Alter Bridge, you know, batch of songs. And I use that just drop the A, drop the E string to an A, just because it, you know, it's fat and low. But he's also doing it on the E string as high E string as well. Is that what you're saying?
So no, the whole thing is tuned in. So imagine your second string. So like the bottom string is A, and you just like tune everything up to A standard. So everything's higher, but then you turn the top two strings.
If you played like an E major shape, an E major shape would play an A major.
I see what you're saying. That's kind of cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then the top two strings are so low that it gives you like that real close piano feel that you get in a lot of those Stevie Wonder where he's just moving one finger and turning it to some crazy chord.
He has a video on YouTube that he goes through. It's pretty great.
I'll check that out. That's awesome.
Absolutely. kind of talking about the writing, you know, for the new Alter Bridge and stuff. When we talked to Mark, he had this really, really interesting like description of his kind of demoing and writing process with like, you know, putting riffs and saving like by like emojis or something and color coding. What is your go-to method, like when you're actually sitting down to write and you're kind of compiling ideas, how do you go about building those tracks?
Kind of the same way, you know. Mark and I both embrace the idea of having a certain fresh perspective. So if you stockpile a bunch of riffs or melodies, chord progressions, whatever it is, and then you can go and you might put an emoji by it to indicate, you know, out of the hundreds or thousands of ideas you have sitting on your phone or laptop or whatever it is, that this is something you should check, make sure you go back to. So you go back and listen with kind of fresh ears. You haven't listened to it 100 times and lost your perspective. And so that's generally what I'll do. And then if I like it, then I'll spend time demoing it. But I will say I've changed a little bit. We used to be a lot better at just sitting around cataloging riffs and ideas and melodies, but I've gotten a little more I don't want to say impatient, but it's almost like I'm bad at organizing. so I feel like, well, if there's something that I like, I'll set it down for an hour or two, come back and listen with fresh ears and go, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and demo that. Let's go ahead and put the rest of, you know, at least do what I call a shell. So let's come up with a verse and a chorus if the riff works, and then I'll hand that over to the guys. And if that's something that they want to, you know, we'll take that and we'll develop it into a full song and arrange it together. But yeah, there used to be a time where Mark and I would have, it was crazy. We would have all these parts and we would lay it out. Do you have a verse that goes with this chorus and it's in this BPM and it's in this key, and it worked well, but it just required an incredible amount of patience and that skill of organizing. And I think he still does that probably more than I do. I could be wrong, but I as the years go on, I'm getting more. I want to hear it done. I want to hear it.
Well, he said he sticks around his house all day singing in his falsetto. So I have to surmise that he's singing for you because he has a wonderful voice himself. Do you ever go over and he's like working on a million songs and he starts singing his Miles falsetto voice at you like, it's like this, dude. And then he's trying to do his, you know, the highest thing he can, and you're trying to decipher it from him, and you're like, Mark, let me sing.
No, but I'll do that. That'd be funny.
So let me ask you, when you get ideas writing something, do you get a melody? Is it a lyric? Do you hear chords? I'm just always curious because I'm not much of a writer. So what is it that pops into your head when you get the initial idea?
Well, it depends. So if I'm playing a riff, if I've got some sort of thing that happens and it feels good, the just kind of flow, that'll be the genesis of it. Sometimes, like the other day, I was hanging out, just walking around the house, and I suddenly heard this melody. So I grabbed my phone and tried to remember it and catalog. And then I'll go back and revisit and put chord, you know, build the chord progression and whatnot.
When you say you suddenly heard a melody, what does that mean?
It's like I hear voices in my head to talk to.
Is that the secret?
This is fascinating to me because I'm still waiting for my first good melody to pop in my head. Everything that I think of is like, it's violinized, you know, it's totally different.
That's what makes it you, though. You got to embrace that.
I guess so.
Yeah, if it's violinized, I mean, it could be, don't discount that because you're hearing it, you know, as a violinist. I think that for me, dreaming is a big part of it, too. It's like the title track of this record, of the Ides of March, was the genesis of it happened in as I was coming out of a dream state, you know, just beyond the blue horizon, and I was like, my eyes opened up and I was like, it's kind of early and it's cold, it's January, and I don't want to get up, but I knew it was an important one. I was like, oh, man, just get up, go in the little family room area and grab a guitar and record it. And real quickly, and then go back to bed. So oftentimes the ones that end up becoming important are kind of in that space where your mind is really.
Do you think that's actually tapping into something else? Because it's funny you say that, because I'm working with Shannon Larkin, who's the drummer from Godsmack, and he's one of the most incredible savant guys I've ever met in my life. And he sleeps with a notebook next to his bed because he goes, all of my ideas, and he writes these crazy Pink Floyd lyrics, come from a dream state. And, you know, a lot of people, I play piano, I'm not that great at it. Some people think I'm okay. But I always tell people it just comes through me. Like, I don't really actively think about it. I hear it. I just hear it in my head. And it's like that Frank Zappa idea. Like, if you can get it out of your head and it actually sounds kind of like what you thought, then that's the best. Do you think that your brain is off, like your subconscious is like this different writer than you, and that you have to like argue back and forth?
I kind of feel like when you get out of your own way, that's where the magic is. And it's that way with everything. It's not just music. I feel like, you know, athletes, everything. Once you are able to stay present and kind of whatever that thing is, I can't articulate it, but it is amazing how the universe will kind of inform you. And I've heard songwriters talk about this before, where they're just trying to tap into the song and it's all there. It's just a matter of tapping into it and grabbing it. And there are times where you really just don't feel like it's weird. As a songwriter, you almost feel like, well, it's all there. The universe, it's there in the universe. You know, I'm just channeling something. And some people are like, oh, that's BS, you know, whatever. But that's super, you know, mystic and or whatever you want to, however you want to describe that philosophy. But there have been moments where songs come about and you're like, I don't know how that happened. It really just felt like the universe dropped it in my lap.
Yeah. Have there been any songs that, you know, you really liked the idea, like you got it started and you were rolling and it just wasn't coming together and you kind of had to push through it and it ended up coming out great, or maybe even some that you really, really liked in the going and then you had to, you know, eventually had to bail on?
Oh, geez. So, I mean, so much of the time that sort of thing happens where you just finally throw in the towel. The amount of, and Mark would probably say the same thing, the amount of songs that you start working on that end up being finished are ideas that are floating around that no one will ever hear because you just either couldn't come up with the parts to finish it, or you just, it kind of, the shelf life kind of expired or whatever it is. But then there are those songs where you know you've got something, you know you have something special, right? And the example I was used to, I like to go to for Alter Bridge is Blackbird. Because with Blackbird, we had the beginning of the track, basically the verse, the intro, the verse, and kind of the Pink Floyd-y dun, 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 that part. But we couldn't find a chorus or a bridge or anything. And it was months and months, I want to say like 8 months of pushing to try and find the way to complete that song. And I think we're all really grateful that we didn't give up, because it essentially became one of the most important tracks in our catalog. And in a way, it was kind of like, I feel like that was the genesis of what Alter Bridge would become. As you know, it was like once that song was established, we were like, the four of us, I think, felt like, okay, now we know where we want to go as a band. We were still trying to figure that out, given where they came from and where I came from and how to make it work. And we established, you know, the One Day Remains record, which was fun, but we were still on that Blackbird album and writing era. We're trying to figure things out. You know, where are we heading? So that was one of those moments where I always remind myself, when something's really difficult, as far as a part I'm chasing down or we're chasing down, if you really believe in it and think it's something special, don't abandon it. Come back and revisit it later, because you never know, it might become your next Blackbird.
That's a huge thing that I think is important, because there's a lot of people. So for example, I've learned to judge people on the music that they don't release versus what they do release. So like Prince or like Van Halen, because like, you know, I bet you Van Halen has 35 more albums of better stuff than like Van Halen 1. But then you hear like the last album was like the leftover demos. But then you think to yourself, why the hell would you care if Eddie Van Halen made 7,000 songs in 1977 and he put them back out? Just like, you know, again, you know, you play with Slash, Axl Rose, they're saying he's playing these songs he's done forever. But like, he's such a consummate songwriter that like, why wouldn't you go back to these tapes? And isn't that awesome that you have so much stuff around that all you need to do is like go listen to it again and be like, that was a week in 1989 and shit, that's a good single for now.
Right. I agree with that. I think that, you know, some people really like the idea that it's something has been developed recently, and it's, but for me, a good song is a good song. And there have been plenty of songs, even on this last, on the Ides of March album, there's a song on there called Love Rain Down, which that track is 11 years old, you know, and on the first, on
go your, buy it, people go buy the Ides of March, which by the way, I'm very disappointed that you didn't do a vinyl that was signed so I could actually have a better display than having to buy this antiquated thing. They're like CD case thing. So, well, you know,
I'll get you one. I appreciate you, man. That's amazing.
Benny is the extreme music fan for sure.
Speaking of extreme, that's a great thing, because this is one of the greatest nights of my life. This is a set list. Hold on. From Alter Bridge, from April 22nd, 2014. Wow. Okay. And the reason it's so special, one, it's the first time I saw you, and I remember making a mental note as the curmudgeonly person that I am. That guy's pretty good. And then it was also the night I met my hero, Nuno Betancourt, who was on our show just the other night. And we actually had a moment where we're in this little booth watching you play. And you played a little bit of the Beatles, I think, Blackbird, before you went into Blackbird. And Nuno and I put our arms around each other because we were drunk. And we started singing Blackbird. And I said to myself, I'm standing with Nuno. singing the Beatles. And then there's Miles, and then there's Mark Tremonti. Like, does life get better than this? And we played with Nino, but it was so all downhill from there. But this has been on my wall since 2014.
That's amazing. Well, that's amazing. So you are a Nuno fan as well. And Nuno was actually one of those guys right around when I discovered Frank Gambale and a lot of the guys that in some ways made me want to burn my guitars because they were so good. And he was definitely one of those cats when I heard, what was the track that was on the Bill and Ted's Adventure?
Play With Me.
Play With Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I was just
Beethoven.
What is happening? Who is that on guitar? So I went and I bought the cassette. And we'll talk about a ferocious player. Jeez. His picking technique is insane. How does he do that?
Been trying to figure that out for many, many years.
No, I'm telling you right now, it's anger. We just did a crazy, so I have a love-hate relationship with him. And, you know, we just did an interview for Guitar World, which is the most synchronistic universe manifestation for me. Because if you'd asked me when I was 14, like, who would you want to be in Guitar World with? Nuno. And the guy at Guitar World goes, how did you get him to play with such chromaticism? And I'm like, dude, I don't know what that means, but I think it was anger. It's anger. That's what Nuno focuses it, because I'm married, well, I'm engaged to a Portuguese from the same island, and she has the same anger for which Nuno's right hand
I would
works.
Call it intensity. So, I'm not sure that I would call it anger, but yeah, I hear what
whatever,
you're saying.
Whatever, but I'm telling you, it's a Portuguese thing and Boston thing, because I think the mixture between Boston and Portugal is the answer to your question. It's like that I'm in the line at Dunkin' Donuts, but I also come from a beautiful place to go back to that place, but it costs money, so I'm just going to play as fast as I can so I can earn money to go back there.
That's a very fascinating concept. I dig it. I think it's cool.
Well, going back, I wanted to ask you a question about Blackbird. So you mentioned that you had to wait this long period of time to have that breakthrough moment of the song kind of coming to completion. What was that moment like? Like, what was it that triggered that idea that kind of pulled it all together?
Okay, well, so we were in the rehearsal studio where we'd been for months and months and months, it was just an arduous process, and we were revisiting that song among other songs, and we kept getting to what was going to be the chorus, and there's nothing. So we finally look at each other and we're like, let's just disappear. Mark and I were like, let's just go in separate rooms and see, we're going to do it. We're going to come up with it this afternoon and just move on. So I went in this other room, and there are other bands rehearsing, right? There's all this noise. It was basically just this total.
So which one of you is David Bowie and which one of you is Freddie Mercury before Under Pressure? You're going separate rooms.
You're going separate rooms.
Keep the Pandas Apart.
That's what an incredible story about how that song was. I just watched a documentary on that. It's just amazing. But anyways, I'm going off.
We can always go to Queen. I love that.
So there was all this, just there was a cacophony of just sound. Like, there were no real, there were no chord progressions or melody.
Did you say cacophony?
Exactly, Jason Becker.
This is his actual guitar.
Is it really?
And I'm wearing his shirt because I was actually going to try to tell you. I guess, thank you for the awesome, awesome open. Sorry,
well,
I know everyone's cringing.
Let's finish the story.
Finish your statement,
we'll come back to
and
it.
We'll go back to it.
So anyways, it was just this cacophony of just sounds. And out of that, like, it was kind of like, all of a sudden I just heard it. It was just like, da 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 da, blackbird fly away, may you never be broken again. And I grabbed the guitar and I was like, well, I mean, I think that's what the universe just informed me with. And I ran back into the main room and said, hey, what do you guys think of this? And that was it. And that was what was fascinating, was we plugged that chorus in. And then the bridge part just kind of happened. It was like, let's go to this change here. The bridge is interesting because to me it's very Buckley. It's like what Buckley, harmonically, it's where Buckley goes with certain things when he's building things up. So we went there and kind of, it just blossomed. And then I came up with this little dun 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 dun, dun, and Mark had that really awesome bridge part on top, that's like secondary bridge that I solo over. But it was, what was really cool was we were playing the song. We were on the home stretch. We're like, we've got it. Like, we're 5 minutes in, the song is done. And then you know, on the outro, Mark's like, do that thing you were doing during the breakdown of the bridge and put that over the top of it. And it all just kind of, it happened. So we recorded it, put it on my laptop. And I remember going back to his house later that night, doing like the 2 or 3 hour rule, not listening to it, and then pressing play and sitting there for 7 minutes and just going, oh, we finally did. I called and I was like, you got to get in here. And it was just a wonderful, I mean, it was just the moment I'll never forget. I will never, ever forget that. I'll never forget us, him and I sitting together, looking at each other, just going, we did it. We finally tamed that beast. And it was wonderful. Yeah.
That's an amazing story.
Wow, dude, that's intense. So I guess I'll follow it with the, I'm just soaking it in because sometimes I actually do appreciate things and internalize them. But you said cacophony, and it's a great open because I'm trying to raise awareness for ALS. That's why I'm wearing my Suck Up Jason Becker shirt, which, by the way, he sent me, which makes me feel really good about myself because they sent this for me. But we purchased all of his guitars to raise money for him and his family. And the promise that we made to Jason was we wanted to keep putting this guitar in people's hands so that, you know, we could continue to raise awareness because he's by far not the only person with ALS, and there's awareness. And a lot of people, you would think, obviously, I know you're a very studious guitarist, but there's a lot of people that don't know his story. And for me, like, one of my biggest inspirations, whenever I was like, oh, I can't learn this, or how am I ever going to be good? I would go listen to Jason Becker and watch his story and be like, shame on you. Go practice. So I championed a hashtag ALS awareness for Jason. And I had like Nita Strauss from Alice Cooper play this on stage for Schools Out. My friends in Godsmack have committed to playing it on stage. And we had Cradle Filth come down, Gary Sharon and Pat Badger shot with this. So I wanted to invite you, if you're ever in Boston, to come play Jason's guitar and, you know, help raise awareness for ALS. That simple.
I would be honored. I think that's amazing that you're doing that. His story is so, it's an incredible story. I mean, I remember hearing about him initially through, you know, Cacophony, because I was that geeky kid reading all the guitar magazines and all that. And when I heard what him and Marty were doing, I was like, oh, once again, it was kind of like Nuno and Frank and Bob. It's like, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to achieve that level of technical prowess. So you just admire it from afar and go, wow. And then he gets the David Lee Roth gig, and you know, then you know the rest of the story. And it's just a, you know, it's an inspiring story because he still, you know, he went on composing, found a way to still create. Not like he just, it's really, I don't know. It's really interesting. It's like the universe right now is doing something, because I remember thinking about his situation about 2 weeks ago. I don't know, for whatever reason, it just came to mind. So the fact that this is happening is like, fascinating. Yeah, he's definitely an inspiring individual, without a doubt. So I would be honored.
Well, and my goal, just so you know, and I said this to him on the phone, which is crazy because you have to talk to his mom, who interprets his handler, who's basically reading his eyes. So it's right. It's hard not to cry, you know what I mean? But what I want to do is I want to help co-produce a song with him, because I think that the problem, you know, first off, imagine being locked in your mind and you're Chopin, right? And you have an Ouija board and you're like, but I'm saying pianissimo at the fourth bar to someone who doesn't know music. So it's gotta be really hard for him to get it all out. Whereas I'd like to think I'm an okay composer, so maybe I can throw a bunch of stuff at him and he says what piece of crap of my music is any good, and then gives me direction. And then maybe he and I can figure out a way. So I want to try doing that, because I feel like everything that's been done for Jason is, let's find all the craziest guitar players in the world and have them shred. Whereas the thing that made me love Jason and Marty Friedman was that they were so well composed despite being so over the top, which is what I love about your playing, because you, even though you don't play as fast as them, you play the right notes. And that's the thing I think is most important in a guitar player. And you play with Tremonti and Slash, so they clearly think you're okay too.
Well, that's, you know, that's, I don't know, I think it's really cool what you're doing, though. That's really, really amazing, so keep it up. I would be honored. Next time I'm in Boston, we'll get in touch, and I would be thrilled.
Amazing. Well, so coming back to you and to songwriting and, you know, talking about Mark Tremonti, can you tell us a little bit about the story of how you two got connected, the genesis of Alter Bridge, just maybe for the listeners that might not be familiar with your journey? I think, you know, it would be great to hear how that came about.
Sure. So with Alter Bridge, I guess the first time I met those guys was in 1998. I was in a band called the Mayfield Four, and we were opening for Creed it was before they were the massive entity they became, like in 99 and 2000. So it was like July of 1998, and we opened the tour. It was us first and a band called Fuel, who had a few hits at the time, and then Creed closed the show. And I didn't have a ton of interaction with those guys. I think that I think Mark and I, the extent of our meeting was in the cafeteria at the Hard Rock, just kind of passing by, and we're like, oh yeah, we're on the tour together, and we kind of bump fists and nice to see you. So I was really surprised when 5 years later I get this phone call right around Thanksgiving of 2003, and it's Mark, and he's basically reaching out to see if I'd be interested in maybe doing something. And next thing you know, 6 weeks later, I'm in Orlando, and we're working on songs, and a lot of which he'd already had written. So it was wonderful, because I came down and just here's a track, sing this. And so we were able to get the machine up and rolling really quickly. But that was how it all came to be.
So was he silently watching you for all that period? That's so interesting that you don't hear from him for years, and then all of a sudden you get a phone call. So something else must have been going on, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because someone from the label, my A&R person, or somebody there called and told me, yeah, Mark Tremonti called asking for your information. I was like, what? Really? And it was like a few months prior to the call. So yeah, I didn't know what was going on there. And I guess what happened was there was a friend of his who played him the second record that Mayfield did called Second Skin. And there's a track on there called Summer Girl. And I guess when he heard that track, he really liked that, and he really liked the vocals on it. And I think that was maybe the catalyst for reaching out. So yeah, you'd have to ask him the specifics, but
it sounds to me like a lot of people are trying to like stalk you as a musician, because you have Tremonti sees you 5 years before. But then I read a story about Jimmy Page or one of the Zeppelin camp called you because you just happened to do a cover of Zeppelin over the pond at Wembley, which, by the way, like, that's a gravitas ballsy move. And I've seen the video, so mission accomplished, sir. But I heard that you got the call. You know, Mark talked about it. I have to ask you, you've worked with Slash, who is a goat of mine. You have Tremonti, who, like, by many people, like, is the end-all be-all, but you got Jimmy Page in a room with you. What the fuck goes through your mind?
Pretty much the I always bring up the ideas, am I living in the Matrix? Is this real?
Right.
Are you real? Is this real? Come on, like, what are the chances? Seriously? Yeah, that was a very special period in life. Yeah, I got a call from, I'd met Jason Bonham during the filming of Rockstar, and we were actually rehearsing some of the scenes, and there's just some downtime, and I remember sitting down next to him just expressing my appreciation for his father's legacy. And what I discovered very quickly is how receptive he is to that, because he's so proud of everything his dad achieved and that band, and so that was really neat. So fast forward, geez, what was it? 7 years later, something like that. And I get this text from Jason, and I'm in Germany, and we just played a festival in Germany. I think in the Rock'em Park. I think we just played. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, I have a favor. Can you call me? So I'm like, sure. I thought he wanted tickets for a friend of his over in Europe for a show or something. And he basically laid it out. He's like, yeah, I'm here in London jamming with some friends, as he said. We were just wondering if you'd be interested in coming over this weekend to jam. And I was like, well, who are your friends? And then he told me, and I was like, it was just surreal. And so I said, well, yeah, I'll see you this weekend.
Wow. How do you feel stepping into situations like that? I mean, I feel like this is something that I've felt in various ways, that you do stuff and you're never really ready for it. You just kind of have to do it, you know? So I don't know if you relate to that, or, you know, if you ever feel ready for the things that you do. But how did you feel at that moment?
It's so true what you say. You never, at least I don't, ever feel completely ready. There's always more work to be done before you're put in that realm, that of that magnitude, I should say. I think that what I told myself, obviously I was excited, freaked out, every emotion you could fathom. I remember the next day, we went to Rock 'Em Ring there in Nuremberg, and mm-hmm. and there's a, where the bands hang out, there's like a big track. And
yeah, my band played there a couple of years ago, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. It's really cool. And I remember just walking it, running the situation through my mind. What was this going to be? How, you know, and all these emotions were happening. I was just trying to work through it, and I told myself by the end of that little walk, I was like, you know what, I'm going to just enjoy this. I'm just going to go in and have fun and take the ego out of the equation. Yeah, it is what it is, and just be grateful that you get to step in a room with these guys. The guys who ultimately, and I told them this, and it was a very Chris Farley moment where I looked at them and I said, "You guys basically wrote the blueprint for everything that I do." And the minute they just kind of looked at me like. But you know, it's like they probably heard it 1,000 times, and they were pretty good and whatnot. But the minute, right after it came out of my mouth, I was like Chris Farley when he's interviewing
yeah. Paul McCartney. You remember?
Did you really die? Yeah. Did you really die?
Exactly. But it was wonderful. I'm grateful for it. Beyond grateful. Yeah.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. I see Ben patiently waiting with his list of questions.
Well, so that he knows. So Miles, I don't ever prepare, but like there were so many things that I wanted to ask you, because okay, this is one, because you have a new single out called 1,000 Words, and I watched this video and I'm a stoner, okay. Did you like get wicked high and then watch Dire Straits and Aha and like and Peter Gabriel and be like, let's do that? Because that's how I felt when I, and by the way, that's like the greatest concoction. Like if you were a bartender, take that note. One part Aha, two parts Sultan of Swing, and then a little Sledgehammer.
Right.
And we got Miles Kennedy's video. Can you tell us about it? It's called 1,000 Words. I wrote it down.
1,000
no,
words.
No, that's not. That's from. No, that's. I can't even read my own. I love that song, but that's not the one we're talking about. What's the name of the new single? Because I can't even read my handwriting.
So 1,000 words. We also did that same director Stefano did that video, and he also did the first one, which is the same sort of thing, which is In Stride. So that they're very similar in terms of the overall vibe, and that's what he did.
But it's not the same song.
It's all right. It's all good.
That's what happens when you take notes, Ben. You just need to go with what's in your brain.
Well, I mean, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff. So, like, I wrote that Moonshot, he was debating between D major or D minor. And I wanted to say D minor was so right. Because one of the things that you need to know about is that, like, I love when people take the road less traveled. And, like, you do that so pleasantly with your harmony.
You know what? I got to tell you, that means you have no idea how much that means. Because I'm obsessed about that change for 2 hours. And I was thinking about it the other day, because I do these Q&As during my live thing, sometimes during for this meet and greet. And so during the Q&A, I was telling the story about this, how that song was put together. And I made it sound like it was really easy and it was written in like 2 hours. But then I realized that change, in and of itself, trying to figure out whether to go to this, you know, you're going to go G, and then we could go D major. That's what the ear wants to hear. But then I was like, you know, if you just flatten, they take that third and drop it a half step, it's going to make it a little darker, you know, instead of in Moonshot, we can't stop. And I was like, that's going to make that melody just go, it's going to be so unpredictable. And I was like, you know, as a songwriter, how many times have you done that predictable thing? I was like, let's screw with that minor third. Let's take that minor third and then take the melody and weave accordingly. And so to hear you say that you picked up on that makes me feel so good, because it's so much obsession. I remember my call my wife and like, hey, does this sound weird to you? change. She's like, no, honey, it sounds just fine.
But isn't that one of those things when you grow up, you're like, okay, I love that the Beatles did this and that Freddie Mercury did this crazy vocal thing, but it only works if you hit the seventh chord. And like, I feel like you make an internal thing, like you were saying earlier with Jeff Buckley. You're like, well, we're building it up like Jeff would. And if anyone listened to Jeff Buckley, first off, one of the greatest guitar players that doesn't get the credit that he deserves. I mean, he's was this very studious guy, but his chord progressions as a singer-songwriter is right up there at the top for me as far as his ability to just play these crazy inversions and the way he goes from things. And it's so decisive. And I feel like that's one of the things I love about your playing is what made Jeff Buckley good was because he underplayed for himself, but for the average listener, it was like, what the hell is he doing? That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeff was, I agree. I could not agree more. He is so underrated. It's one of those things because he's such an exceptional vocalist that his guitar chops were, you know, was it Rick Beato that was telling me this recently that he went to Musicians Institute and apparently he could shred with the best of them. He could hang on hang out with a lot of those guys. And, but when he became the singer songwriter that we know him as, and keep in mind, this was in the early to mid 90s when that more technical prowess was kind of shunned for a little while. So I could maybe understand why he chose to take a different direction. You know, approach his things musically and harmonically the way he did, and I'm glad because it was so. It was like Jimmy Page. He was like the combination of, it was like Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, and I don't know. I mean, I insert genius.
combination. Why are they not genius? Isn't that redundant? If you said absolutely. Robert Plant and absolutely. Jimmy Page, like they're both geniuses.
Absolutely, but he was the one person. Well, you know, he was able to take all of that and make it as one guy, and it was exceptional. I saw him perform in May of 1995. On that, I think it was the Mystery White Boy tour. It was a little theater, about 500 people, and it was probably the most intense musical experience I'll ever have. When he played the song Grace, and he got to the end of the song, you know, wait in the fire, wait in the fire, and he goes higher and higher and higher, and then he just hits those high notes. You know, as you all probably, we're all addicted to music because we're addicted to those goosebumps. You get goosebumps, or sometimes it'll make you tear up. Music,
the free song.
Exactly. It's an extremely powerful medium. I remember sitting there as he was performing that song, and it was beyond goosebumps. It was beyond tears. It was like a state of, it was like transcendent. It was absolutely incredible. And I remember looking around the room and everyone was just, I've never seen anything like it.
I just made a crazy observation after listening to you say that I've noticed that a lot of the greatest musicians that come on to our show have like a Rain Man like memory. It was like, it was a March. It was in March on a Wednesday. I was wearing black shoes and I was because you have these operant conditioned moments. Like I remember when I saw Dimebag Darrell for the last time. I remember his solo almost note for note in my head. I can't remember what I did 3 minutes ago or where my keys are. And I think that that's amazing because when you're talking about music and I've seen other interviews, you're like, it was a gloomy day when I was in London, but man, the lyrics came. I'm like, how does he remember this shit? But then I realize it's because you're so passionate about it that it takes you to a moment. It's like a photograph for you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. I don't have a really incredible memory by, in fact, I'm one of these guys, like lyrically, I can't remember my own lyrics to save my life, but as far as like important musical moments, yeah, those are kind of, you know, all the details. And
March 19th, 1982, what happened?
March 19th, 1982.
Come on, Ben, what are you getting at? Why don't you?
Well, it's okay. This is a great segue because one of the things that this makes me think of,
Randy Rhoads,
I have,
what you're talking about.
Yep, I have Miles Kennedy and Slash. So this, other than Ozzy Osbourne, Randy Rhoads, I've never seen a guitar player of this level ever get the same kind of billing. But Randy Rhoads, we lost on March 19th, 1982. And Ozzy said that the first time he ever did a double billing was with Randy, Ozzy slash Randy. And I thought that that was really interesting because I've been looking at the Slash Miles Kennedy record. And I think that it's pretty amazing that it's Slash with Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators that they actually put your name because you're an A-lister with Slash.
Well, I don't know.
Like Randy. with Ozzy,
but
not the guitarist.
That's it. I can't believe you have all this stuff. This is incredible. Like, you've got all this stuff framed. Like,
I'm the biggest nerd you've ever met, man.
It's pretty wild what he's got in there. Yeah.
I love this. You know what I have? I'm going to share this with you since we're all fellow music geeks. I'm going to grab it right now.
It is perfectly blurred out background at 2.8.
Yeah,
it's coming in.
Good, 2.8. So smart. I like it. You know what this is? This is Johnny Winter's beard right here.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome. Wow.
Is there a story behind that?
I'm like getting ready to cut it. And this was May of 1980 when he cut it. And there's the actual beard right there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's pretty freaking badass. Wow.
I'm
just stunned.
My agent, actually, he gave that to me, and I thought that was one of the coolest. My booking agent in Europe, John Jackson, gave that to me, and I thought that was one of the coolest. Yeah.
Oh,
you got to step up your game, Ben.
Well, actually, I have the most random thing ever that somebody gave me. This is a piece of Elvis's car. Some dude made these, actually took up the upholstery and reupholstered his like 56 Chevy or whatever, and then cut up the upholstery and then made these beautiful Elvis cards so he can give out a little piece of Elvis's ass mark of the Chevy. So, I mean, if that's not cool, I don't know what is.
That's pretty damn cool. That's right. Pretty big.
It's going to be hard to top, but as we wind down in our part one, our first hour here with Miles, once again, we appreciate you hanging with us. Hope you'll stick around for part two, and I think we can, you know... dive a little.
Did you notice how crisp his microphone sounded the whole time? It's so crisp.
It's incredible. It's so nice to listen to. I don't even want to talk. It ruined
it. I'm a little ashamed. How does one go and buy one? Because I feel like that's something we should tell them as a business write-off for our company.
You know, you can go to mileskennedy.com. I mean,
will it make me sound like you? Can I sing like you if I have this? Will it make me sound
better?
Does it come
with the talent?
Yeah.
Got a flex capacitor built in. You can sing any, you know. There you go.
Okay. Amazing.
It's the Rob Halford setting.
Well, check out 2020-D.com and stay tuned for part two with Miles Kennedy. Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode 109, featuring Nuno Betancourt of Extreme. Check it out.
Fuck all that. What I walked away from was doing an album with fucking Ozzy as me. Do you understand? Like me being the Randy Rhoads, me being that fucking Jakey Lee, me being that guy. They said it to me. It's like, you go to the fucking airport right now and you fucking tell Extreme to go fuck themselves and you got a jet waiting, private jet. I want a private jet for the rest of the fucking year and the rest of the fucking 2 years, and I'm fucking doing the next Ozzy album and I'm fucking writing songs and I'm writing the next Mr. Fucking Crawler. How about that? Fucking bullshit. Like, as a kid, thinking that I had the possibility to fucking do that. And I was like, no. I'm a high school dropout. I'm stupid. No.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs. But what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.